Superfly, Curtis Mayfield. Hey, welcome to our friends around the globe, and welcome to The Buzz, Studio W Buzz, your global radio network. We circle this thing 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, with the finest in broadcasting anywhere around the globe. And now it's time for the Eating as an Act of Worship Ministries radio show with your host, Ann Wooten Till, and special guest, Mr. Elroy Boyd III, a.k.a. Professor Pop Culture.
Surprise, surprise.
Surprise, surprise.
Surprise, surprise. Anyway, I know this is going to be a wonderful show, so I'm going to step aside.
What?
And listen.
I fully anticipated that you would butt in, and I'm okay with that, William. I know that the two of you are great friends.
Yes.
And he's going to be with us all day because he's going to be on the Teen Stop Truth radio show next.
Wow. Outstanding.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yes. Okay. So we are so excited to have Professor Boyd with us today.
Thank you
so much. Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Bye.
And William, thank you for playing the Superfly song. It was so apropos. we needed that. I was trying not to dance. I'm like, some folks will get all up in their feelings because the Christian ladies danced into Superfly.
They just need to sit down somewhere.
I know, right? But you know, you just can't help but groove to that song. It is awesome. But anyway, that was me. My dad, he loved music. So in our house, especially on Saturday mornings when he didn't have to work, we woke up to the house just vibrating with the bass from music. That's how he woke us up on Saturdays with.
Beautiful.
It was just wonderful growing up that way. But I've got to tell you guys a little bit about, I guess, me and the show before we jump into everything. But William, if you want to stick around and say hello to your friend and talk, you can. I give you permission.
Well, thank you. You're so generous. Thank you, Anna.
There it starts.
You know us so well, Professor.
She's such a peach. She's such a peach. I mean, no, it's my great friend.
That's right. I'm a Southern Belle, and I'm sweet and so, right. Look, as my husband would say, he nice to you.
Oh.
Anyway, for those of you who are new to the show, I'm Ann Wooten Taylor. I'm the CEO of Eating as an Act of Worship Ministries, and welcome to the Eating as an Act of Worship Ministries radio show. As you can see, we love to have fun, but we also love to help you get healthy and fit through Jesus Christ. We are a nonprofit organization. We teach the biblical principles about the body, dieting, exercising, and maintaining a healthy body for the glory of God. We do that through our 12-week health and fitness course, which is going to start up again. For those of you who've missed it, we'll be starting up again in August, on August 19th. That's right. We'll keep you posted so you don't have to worry about it. We'll let you know when registration's open so you get everything together. And for those who are wondering, the class is free. That's right. The class is free. No registration fees or membership fees. Only thing you're responsible for is the cost of your Eating as an Act of Worship workbook. And we'll talk about that again in a moment too. But first up, it's time for your weekly motivation. For those of you who are used to the motivation, you know it's designed to encourage you to stay the course if you've been doing well on your health and fitness journey. If you've fallen down somewhere along the way, we want to inspire you to get up and try again. And if you haven't been able to find a reason to get healthy and fit on your own, we want to motivate you today through Jesus Christ. So today's motivation is entitled, Stop Being Selfish. Selfishness is an irrevocable part of sin. As Christians, we're commanded to deny the desires of our flesh in order to obey the commandments of God and be effective servants in His kingdom as well as towards our fellow man. In contrast, when we sin, we give in to the desires of our flesh in selfish disobedience. This act of rebellion makes us ineffective, as the world sees itself-centeredness reflected in our behavior. Moreover, repeatedly giving in to the carnal desires of your flesh results in a selfish mentality. Consequently, it becomes increasingly difficult to accept the Lord's call for change in your life when everything's always all about you, meaning what you like, what you want, what you think you need, and what it'll cost you personally to forego your desires in order to benefit the kingdom of God or someone else. It's no different with the sins of gluttony and otherwise failing to eat and drink for the glory of God. In fact, in some ways it's worse. For example, gluttony begins with a single act of overeating or overindulging in unhealthy foods and beverages. However, over time, it becomes a pattern of overeating and overindulgence, which begins to affect your outlook about yourself. In other words, you graduate from simply rebelling against God's commands to being completely self-centered in your thoughts, your emotions, and your behavior as it relates to food and beverages. For instance, your thoughts are focused more and more on what you are in the mood to eat, even after consuming large, unhealthy meals. As your waistline expands, your selfishness begins to work against you, making you self-conscious about your appearance, concerned about your health, and afraid that you won't be able to regain control of this area of your life. These negative emotions become evident in your behavior as you ostracize yourself from others to avoid unflattering comments and stares. Furthermore, you stop participating in many activities you enjoy for the same reasons. All of that changes once you repent from committing the sin of gluttony and begin to reverse the process of selfishness that invaded your life. It's the same when you eat and drink for the glory of God instead of remaining in bondage to your eating disorder. As you deny yourself in obedience to the one true living God, you become more and more selfless in terms of this and any other sin you're entangled with. After you discipline your body and bring it under subjection through Christ, then your focus should shift to shining the light of Christ on others who are suffering under the weight of bondage to gluttony and eating disorders. This usually begins with your own household. The Bible says that he who fails to provide for his own family has denied his faith and is worse than an infidel. One of the most important things you can provide for the ones you love is covering them daily with your prayers. Ask for God's mercy, deliverance, favor, protection, and mind renewal so that they will make a permanent health and fitness change through Christ. And then effectively be about the Father's business to lead others to deliverance from gluttony and eating disorders through him. If you're ready to stop being selfish and obey God's commands to take care of your body, which is the temple of the Holy Spirit, by eating and drinking for his glory, purchase your copies of the Eating as an Act of Worship workbook and the Eating as an Act of Worship Teacher's Edition online today at Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com. In the books, you'll learn the biblical principles about the body, dieting, exercising, and maintaining a healthy body for the glory of God. Don't forget to read our weekly blog for motivation to stay healthy and fit through Christ, and follow us daily on Facebook, Threads, LinkedIn, and Pinterest for recipes and diet and exercise tips. You can also tune in to our syndicated radio show on iTunes, Spotify, The Narrative Matters, Studio W Buzz, and Victory, KVDW 100.9 FM, 95.3 FM, and 1530 AM in Little Rock for interviews and health and fitness trends. Lastly, please make your tax-deductible donation to Eating as an Act of Worship Ministries at www.eatingasanactofworshipministries.org. All right, everybody. That's your motivation for this week. We hope and pray it encourages you to stay the course if you've been doing well on your health and fitness journey, that it inspires you to get up and try again if you fell down somewhere along the way. And if you haven't been able to find a reason to get motivated to take charge of your health and fitness, we hope and pray you've been motivated to do so today through Christ. Thanks everybody for listening. It's now time for one of our favorite guests. It's been a while since he's been here. I think the last time he was here, we talked about his book on Michael Jackson. Which was awesome because I learned a lot. I had no idea that the rivalry between Michael Jackson and Prince was real. That's one of the things that I took away from it, because for me, I thought that was one of those, you know, industry things where they seem to kind of, you know, dust up stuff, like they try to make a big deal between Beyonce and Taylor Swift. I'm like, there's room on the planet of 8 billion people for the both of them to be successful. But you taught me a lot, Mr. Elroy Boyd, or as we will be calling him today, Professor Boyd the Third, is originally from Washington, D.C. He was raised in Manassas, Virginia, and he's a product of the historical black institution, Norfolk State University. He graduated with a degree of mass communications in 1992, and he received his first master's degree from Old Dominion University in 1995. He taught for Halifax County Public Schools in Halifax County, North Carolina, and he's done postgraduate study at the Yale School of Drama and East Carolina University. He received his MFA degree from Virginia Commonwealth University in 2002 in theater pedagogy and has done additional graduate work there. Professor Boyd taught at Virginia Union University for 19 years. He also taught middle school and high school for the Chesterfield County School System in Chesterfield, Virginia. And currently, he's a professor of speech and theater at Virginia State University. Professor Boyd has been teaching and directing in educational theater for nearly 30 years in Virginia and North Carolina. He's a historian in African American film history, specializing in race movies and soul cinema film. Welcome to the show, Professor Boyd. It's so wonderful to have you again.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I've got to say, knowing that you are a historian in African American film history, specializing in race movies, brings into focus the Superfly trilogy. Is that why you chose to write this book?
Partially, yes. It kind of came out of an experience that I had about 15, 17 years ago, mm-hmm. of a class that I taught at an institution on soul cinema film. Mm. It was 3 hours a week. Mm. Once a week, we would watch these films, and then afterwards we would discuss them. And prior, mm. before I would show them, I would give the background, mm-hmm. To these films. And believe it or not, as much of a fun class as many of the students felt that it was, there was a great deal of assessment with it as well. Mm-hmm. And that was part of it. The other part was, of course, what is it, Anne? Social media, Facebook. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was, I'm trying to do some math here. It was about 5-7 years ago, I was scrolling and I noticed the preview mm-hmm. or the reboot, mm-hmm. The reproduction of Superfly mm-hmm. in 2018. And I thought, okay, this is interesting mm-hmm. because I was about to start another book on another icon, another musical icon. But mm-hmm. then I looked at this video and I this trailer, and I remembered about how intrigued the students in the class were mm-hmm. about this particular film. You know, look, we saw mm-hmm. all of these films. We saw The Learning Tree, Sweetback, Shaft, The mm-hmm. Mac, Coffee, mm-hmm. Foxy Brown. We saw them all, but Superfly, really brought kind of a moral discussion after the film about whether or not they would stay in the life if they mm-hmm. were a priest, or mm-hmm. if they were trying to get out of it. Mm-hmm. And it was very interesting. And what was most intriguing with a lot of the students was when I mentioned that there were two more sequels mm-hmm. following this film. The biggest response that I got every time was, "You mean there's more?" I don't think it was that as excitement or the, you know, want to see the other. Right. It's just, how can you extend this story? What else is more?
Exactly.
You touch on with this character. So, all of this was just in one night. I saw mm-hmm. this trailer in the afternoon. By evening, I decided I'm going to write a book on this.
Well, you know, you take these topics and because of your wealth of knowledge, you bring to life a dimension and a perspective that I think the rest of us probably never would have even scratched the surface on. For instance, I'm curious about your take because the Superfly trilogy came about during a period that some in the movie industry like to call the blaxploitation films. Is it, in your opinion, does it fall into that supposed genre?
Yes. However, I do not use, the term. Mm-hmm. And in place of it is a term that is used and created by none other of all people, Mario Van Peebles. And
oh,
his
wow.
father, Melvin Van Peebles, started the genre. Mario calls these films soul cinema. So, and in this book, can you see it? You probably can't see it because I have a background the same as this cover. But
right.
In the book, I have a note on one of the pages, and at the bottom of the pages, we will address this genre as soul cinema, as it is culturally appropriate. Because the thing about the whole the quote unquote blaxploitation thing was the term was created out of anger. And it was created out of anger from a black man of all people, not a Caucasian person. And out of anger because of the perception of how African Americans were portrayed on the screen. But the interesting thing about it was the African American man who came up with the term was upset because Warner Brothers, who handled Superfly, would not give him the public relations account to promote the film. So I go into all of those politics, the whole big uprising in the fall of 1972 about all of those films. In fact, Superfly was really the main scapegoat with that friction. And even Cicely Tyson got caught up in the middle of it as well, because she had Sounder coming out that same fall, that same season.
Well, since it's Black History Month, and we're talking about soul cinema, we're talking about 1972, obviously. We're talking about something that happened more than 50 years ago at a time when I think Black cinema was really taking off, getting to become more of the mainstream, or rather opening the door to become more mainstream.
Absolutely.
In my opinion, what did Superfly mean to the Black community? I mean, if it wasn't what they're calling it, blaxploitation, what was it really?
What it meant and was strength. Believe it or not, even though I don't know if I could call Priest a protagonist, because what Priest was, he was an anti-hero. That's what he was. And here's the thing about anti-heroes. If there's anyone who doesn't know what an anti-hero is, an anti-hero in a story is someone who is on the wrong side of the law, so to speak, or the wrong side of morals, but has a morally redeeming part of their character, of their personality. And at the same time, even though they're on the wrong side of it, they are so charismatic and magnetic that we can't help but not take our eyes off of them. And later on in the story, we find ourselves rooting the character. Okay?
Right.
So the thing about it, what it did for us, even though Priest was a dealer, and this is the thing, over and over and over, I keep telling people, he was trying to get out from the very first frame of his image, which is a close-up headshot. Mm-hmm. That first frame of Priest was so important because that was the moment that he decided that he needed to get out. And then, of course, there were several other events that occurred. The mugging that occurred with him when he got to his house, his apartment, and other issues before he tells his partner that he's getting out. Mm-hmm. What it did was the final scene when he tells off the deputy commissioner, the white man who is truly the real kingpin, the one who was bringing all these drugs into the city. Mm-hmm. When he told him off and he told him, I don't work for you and I don't work for nobody. And he called him a pig and other words that I will not use here. But yes, the thing about it is he turned around and he walked back to his Cadillac and he drove off into the sunset. You see, Anne, we have to remember, okay, the race movie period, the independent race movie period, in which we had the first independent cinema in America, African Americans, that ended in 1951. Mm-hmm. From 1951 up until circa 1967, that was called the No Negro period. You saw very little African Americans on screen. Ozzie Davis said, oh, there will be periods where green pastures or something like that would pop up. And then after it would go away, you don't see nothing for another 5 years. And then you have, well, we got to do something. We got to give them something. So we have, Jim Brown in the Dirty Dozen. But then what happened to Jim Brown in the Dirty Dozen, Ann?
Did he die? I didn't see that one.
First one. You're right.
Right.
Okay. That's where the brother, that was the film, the first film when the brother was the first one to die. Mm-hmm. And then, so now we're in civil rights. Mm-hmm. Okay. King is assassinated in 68. Mm-hmm. Okay, the same year that Gordon Parks is hired by Warner Brothers 7 Arts to do The Learning Tree, okay, and 70, you have They Call Me Mr. Tibbs, the sequel to In the Heat of the Night, which in 67, in that film, when Virgil Tibbs is slapped by the white man, he slaps him back.
Yep. And it wasn't in the script, if I understand it
correctly. Never, never before. So we're going up, 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 up. Now we, and then in 1971, Melvin Van Peebles in Sweetback, he gets away from the white man. He gets away from the white cops. Mm-hmm. The first time in the history of motion pictures that a black man was able to get away. That's why Sweetback is so significant. Mm-hmm. So for us, in that time of the Vietnam War, okay, and us feeling our melanin, which was just so high. And even though it was just so high, and what did Verdi and White of Earth, Wind and Fire say? The Afro was the symbol of what? Expanding our consciousness.
Wow.
20 odd years later, people made fun of the platform shoes, but the platform shoes was a symbol. He said the platform shoes was us what?
Elevating.
Standing tall. Yes. You got it. So even though we were looking for a leader, but we were so caught up in our blackness and feeling the pride of it and such, for us to be in that movie theater and to see that black man tell off that white man and to even have a little humor in it and said, nothing better not happen to one hair on my gorgeous head.
Right.
And then go away and to leave America. That's what it was.
Well, I've got to say, you know, again, you've changed my perspective on it because I never thought about the Afro symbolizing an expansion of the mind. Never thought about the platform shoes, as a symbol of elevating or standing upright. And I am a person who loves old movies. My husband, he just watched me, He's like, are you crying? He just feel my face. He wouldn't even look at me. And one of my favorite old movies is Cabin in the Sky.
Oh, yes.
I love that movie. It's just, to me, it's one of the quintessential black movies that you must see if you haven't watched older black movies, because you get to see not just how they lived, but how they lived with dignity and how they how proud they were. But not only that, they made black people look good. I mean, in spite of the fact that they showed the poverty, they showed the struggle.
Yeah.
They also showed it in a way where you could see sort of like how somebody like Superfly would get caught up, the way Little Joe got caught up, wanted to do better, but couldn't. Yes. And I mean, he couldn't even read. Little Joe couldn't even read, but at the same time, there was this desire to have a better life, to do better, but then being in a sense trapped in something that was out of your control. Was that kind of what was happening with Superfly? He's basically a symbol of African Americans at a time period where you know that there's better, you want to get to better, but at the same time you're kind of caught up in something that wasn't really of your making.
There is a through line throughout the entire film. But throughout the entire book. And I call, and that through line is the American dream.
Mm.
And it is that ethos that if one is born in America and works hard and eats their veggies and say their prayers every day and just to work honestly, then you can raise your station. You can pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Now, when that concept eventually became intended for all citizens, regardless of race, color, and creed, but at the time when it was first conceived, it was really aimed toward Caucasian Americans, okay? And as I said, as time went on, it included everyone. But the thing about it is because of both the effects of industrialization and especially post-industrialization America, which had such a heel upon the less fortunate of those in inner cities. Okay, that someone like Priest, who is, yes, a victim of hereditary poverty, had no choice but to be caught along with this. The producer, Sig Shore, the producer of the film, Sig Shore, said that, you know, at that time, you would have these young teens who would have long rap sheets, even at the age of 14. Well, and that's Young Blood Priest. He mentioned in the film that when he was a young boy, he was mentored by the character Scatter. And he said, I was always running errands for you. I was washing your wheel. This far. You were always my man, Scatter. Okay? So, Ron O'Neill even once said that Priest is really a great deal more American than many other Americans as far as the American dream. Yes, he was where he was, but he worked himself off. He worked his backside off. And he, and you see that in the film, how much of a workaholic, he is. Later, he tells his girlfriend Georgia when he, and this is sort of really, I think, proof of his wholesome manhood when he comes toe to toe with his girlfriend and he comes clean with her and he tells her, I have a plan for us to get out of this scene for the rest of our lives. Okay. Now he becomes very serious. They are walking in the park and they are discussing their future and how they're going to get out of it. Probably, the most mature act throughout the entire film, Fun Priest. And he says to her, you know, with my record, I can't even get a civil service job or join the army. Okay. So, you are right, Anne. He's trapped. Now, let's fast forward to Superfly 2018. Going back to the whole thing of the hereditary poverty, the 21st century priest, he discloses that now he's a younger, the age of the character is much younger in this one. He's probably about 21, 22. He says that his records are sealed. Okay. That's number one. That's a change. Two, you said trapped. Superfly 2018 is what in the book I call a trap film. And what is trap? A subculture of hip hop. The 2018 soundtrack, mostly done by the hip hop artist Future, is trap music. Trap is, the expression of the life as originated in the South. Namely Atlanta, Georgia, which is viewed as the trap capital of the world. Trap meaning you're trapped in the life, trapped in the trap house. Okay. So 2018 is very much the trap Superfly, but you, I'm making these connections and making these webs here. For lack of a better term, because the words you're using, you're hitting and you're just on it. You're hitting.
It's always a blessing to talk to you too.
Did you watch the trilogy yourself?
You know, I think I did sneak and watch that one when I was a kid. Like I said, I watched a lot of old movies. Like, of course, didn't sneak and watch Shaft. And of course, when you're growing up and you see those things, you know you are not supposed to. You can get in trouble. But it, you know, it's been a long time ago, when that happened, for me. So you're bringing up some stuff and helping me to remember a lot of the details, from the movies. But keep telling me, because when you say things now, I'm looking at it in a whole different way. For instance, the guy's name Scatter. Now all of a sudden it has a bigger meaning for me, because if he's, you know, a part of this system, maybe unwittingly because he himself is trapped, then he is, you know, living up to the name Scatter instead of, you know, helping to elevate those in his orbit. He's basically doing the opposite of that.
Scatter was a real gentleman.
Really?
The character was based on a real gentleman from Cleveland, Ohio. His name was Herman Scatter Stevens. In fact, Anne, chapter one is titled, It All Began with Scatter.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Well, so the second and the third movies, I'm with your students. are they as profound? Are they continuing the journey that makes you think, that makes you question everything that we knew about society at that time, and in a very real sense, what's happening in our world today? Or, you know, with, is it like, you know, a lot of sequels that we have, it's like by the time you get to the second and third one, it's not worth watching anymore?
A little bit of both. Okay. Superfly TNT and The Return of Superfly very much had profound messages and commentary about the world that we live in at the time of their release. As far as execution and quality, they don't necessarily cut the mustard. Okay. Superfly TNT, which was released not even a complete year after Superfly, was really, I honestly believe, was driven by the greed of Hollywood. You once asked me a little bit earlier, what did Superfly do for Black people? I will tell you what it did for the industry. It showed the white movie industry at that time that there was an audience for these films because of the loads of money that came in. Okay. And because of that, they pushed, okay. Superfly was released in August of 1972. In December of 72, Sig Short calls Ron O'Neill and says, we just got the green light for Superfly 2. And Ron O'Neill's like, we don't even have a script. Okay. January of 1973, and the next month, they start filming.
Filming what if there's no script?
Right. Okay. They had to, it was thrown together. But here's the thing. Now here's where the profound message, comes in. We pick up with Priest in Georgia, who are now in Europe after they left, America. They're like, they are like these wealthy vagabonds all over Europe. And then they end up in Rome. Okay. And for the first half of the film, you hear priests say over and over and over, I don't want to hustle anymore. I don't want to hustle. But then he gets picked up by an African diplomat, portrayed by Roscoe Lee Brown, who is, a diplomat from the faulting West Africa country of Umbria. And they are falling because they are under the heel of white European colonialism. Okay. In order to save his country, he needs somebody to run guns to Umbria. So when he meets Priest and does a backup check on Priest and becomes impressed, even though, yes, he had a sordid past as a dealer, he was impressed because he knew that he needed a man with those capabilities to run his guns underneath the radar back to Umbria so that the Africans can defeat the Europeans to save their country. So when he tries to persuade Priest and to do this, Priest is totally against it. No. No, I'm not going to do it. Don't call me brother and all this. And he says, look, man, I am retired. Can you dig it? And then that was an actual.
Right.
Movie, okay.
Right.
And Roscoe Lee Brown lays him out and it is a very scathing monologue telling him in a nutshell, oh, so you think you're an angel now because you redeemed yourself and you ran away. You have to understand that even with your talents, if you help our revolution, you will in turn help your people back home with their revolution. Oh, so you think that you have changed and you turned your back on that life. Well, guess what? You're still a slave. In fact, you're the worst kind of slave. And that was the last line. You're the worst kind of slave. Which puts Priest in a what? In a guilt trip. And he says, okay, yeah, no. And why? Why? Because the filmmakers wanted to prove to not only to the protesters of Soul Cinema, who were the NAACP, the Urban League, CORE, that they can make a redeeming film. They can make a Soul Cinema film with a positive with positive depictions of African Americans and African people. Okay. But they missed the mark. A lot of people were expecting the soulful soundtrack from Curtis Mayfield. They hired an African band, a West African band who did world music. The editing in some parts, the lighting in a scene or two, it just didn't cut the mustard. Me personally, I like Superfly TNT. I just see more to it than I guess the average person would. I think there was the great expectation of inner city themes that the first one had. But there was an upgrade. There was a little bit of a bourgeoisness to it, and very much profound themes. That was, I think, a little bit too much for audiences at that time. And when you look at it, it does look rushed. And for anyone listening, it's on YouTube. You can just easily watch it, the entire thing. 1990 was the return of Superfly. What hurt that one probably the most was that Ron O'Neill was not in the film. Priest was portrayed by the actor, the soap opera actor, Nathan Perdee, who played Nathan Hastings on The Young and the Restless. So he was Priest. Again, good film, in my opinion. It does grow on you a bit. This was done at the time of the transition from the end of the 80s to the new consciousness that we were beginning to have at the late 80s and the early 90s. The soundtrack was hip hop all the way, with Curtis Mayfield making a return. In fact, the title track, The Return of Superfly, the title track was called Superfly 1990, was Curtis Mayfield and Ice-T together in that. Produced by Lenny Kravitz.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Okay.
that's a threesome that you want in a music, music industry.
Absolutely. And, again, a lot of explosions, a lot of violence. The drug now is crack cocaine. And it was and the theme here pretty much is Priest returns to America. In order not to be tried for his 1972 crimes, because he got caught in customs. The ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms want him to infiltrate the old drug family that he started in 1970, to take down the new leaders who are just worse than he ever was. After a while, he decides he's not going to go with the law. He's going to do it his way. In this film, Priest is 100% anti-drug. And does away, return is more him, is more of him destroying the problem that he created 20 years earlier.
I've got to say, you make this, and it's probably the professor in you, sound interesting. I am an English major, so
okay.
I like, of course, I've had to like reading and all things dealing with literature. And so you sound to me very much like one of my English professors when we're breaking down
okay.
a book. So from your opinion, you know, why is it important to teach this to students at the college level? What do you believe it adds to not just their college experience, but I think for me, books and movies and music and poetry, all those things, especially when done with the genius of the person of who's in the time and able to connect you to the time and the issues that are going on, have a way of enlightening us, and opening, our minds, changing our perspectives in a way that other things just don't. Is that why you teach this to your students? Or is there some other reason?
You hit it right there. You hit it right there. It is, you know, because everything is all connected mm-hmm. and together. And I don't know about others, but for me, it just sort of, and it's interesting. We're talking on Black History Month, February. Mm-hmm. It all rolls back to history.
Right.
And when you know it, then the dark parts you will not repeat. Mm-hmm. When you know it, you find strength in mm-hmm. the past, and you take that strength and that energy and you go forward with it. This film is a document. It mm-hmm. is a document as much as their eyes were watching God. It mm-hmm. is a document mm-hmm. just as much as Invisible Man. It mm-hmm. is a document just as much as the miseducation of the Negro. So mm-hmm. when we take a look at this film and the context of this film to understand that this is not only a remnant of the 1970s, but a Polaroid mm-hmm. for them to see how we as a people, how we were resonating in mm-hmm. the aftermath of the Civil Rights Movement and in the aftermath of Martin Luther King.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Now, the leader who was hot at the time was Jesse, and he had Operation Push, but still, we were still trying to find our way. We're in a new decade and sort of a new, sort of cloud, for lack of a better term. I think we were trying to construct things after such a turbulent, mm-hmm. decade. Okay. Mm-hmm. And as I teach this, again, not only as to present a Polaroid of a particular time, let's connect everything that led us to this point. Mm-hmm. Going back, I think, as you were talking about with, how Priest was trapped. Well, okay, let's take it all the way back to the War on Poverty mm-hmm. in 1964, okay? Because that's what it starts with Lyndon Johnson. The byproduct of the War on Poverty was Nixon's what? The War on Drugs. Interesting how that film was released at the height of the War on Drugs. An official from his I don't want to say his cabinet, but from his staff later admitted to the nation that the war on drugs was really an effort to incarcerate as many African-American men as possible.
Wow. Wow. Okay?
So you have all of these elements here that are contributing to this document. You know, and we are discussing film. Yes, I am a film scholar, and my training is from the theater. And in Hamlet's speech to the players, mm-hmm. Hamlet tells them that we, and he's talking to the actors, the theater people, mm-hmm. we hold the mirror up to mm-hmm. nature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, hey, let's see ourselves. And difference in time mm-hmm. is not really all that important. Our main hot genre as a people is hip-hop. Do you know how much this film has influenced hip-hop culture?
I know, right?
So many hip-hop videos, especially in the mm-hmm. 90s, drew from Superfly. The mm-hmm. Wu-Tang Clan even mm-hmm. has a song entitled Ron O'Neal.
Mm, wow.
Okay.
Wow.
So we should study this, and we should find ourselves and find pride. I was talking to somebody about this the other day. I think, if we analyze these films really, really well, we can learn to enjoy them for their cinematic quality. And mm-hmm. through that analysis, we will not be influenced mm. by the lower entities that are in the celluloid, so to speak.
I've got to say, even the terminology from the film, we still use today. You know how slang terms or mm-hmm. colloquialisms, as we like to say, yes. kind of fade out. We still mm-hmm. use the term fly. I mean,
absolutely.
There's just something about it that, that persists. I mean, people still to this day wear afros. I mean, it never completely went away.
And Ann, you want to know what's interesting that you said that? I have a lexicon.
Do you?
You probably can't see it, but I have a lexicon of the terms in the book for anyone
wow.
who needs it. There's also a cast of characters to mm-hmm. help people to keep track of who I'm discussing. So yeah.
Wow. Wow. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like you said, this is Black History Month, and I thank God for his timing, but because it just seemed like we couldn't get you here to talk about this, but it came exactly when it should have been during this particular season, this particular time.
All right.
And now putting it in context, because you know, you mentioned that they tried to reboot it. It wasn't necessarily a success, I suppose, is a proper term for it. Is it because, you know, what happened back then, in the time frame that Superfly was just all of that? I mean, it was really all of that. I was a baby at the time, but still, growing up, you knew about Superfly, so you just couldn't, couldn't help it. Is it that what was going on at that time couldn't necessarily fit into what we have happening here? We still obviously have lots of issues, but at the same time, you've had your Barack Obama as president, your Kamala Harris as vice president. You've got, you know, not just Thurgood Marshall, but Ketanji Brown Jackson, and so many others. Was that the difference? Is that what made Superfly, basically just the epitome of Black cinema in its time versus them trying to redo it in today's society.
The reboot really started with Seek Shore, going as far back as 2006. The success of Superfly was so meaningful for him. He tried three other times to replicate it. He just could not do it as well as he did that first time in 1972. So in 2006, look, even Return of the Superfly, the Return of Superfly, he directed that one. He produced and directed it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And that was in 1989, 1990. So here we are, 2006. He tries one more time, and unfortunately, he passes away. At the time that he passed away, he was in talks with Sony for the reboot. So Sony buys the rights from Warner Brothers. His son, Stephen Shore, becomes the executive producer to keep it all in the family. So I'm bringing all this up because it may not have happened had it not been for him. Now, Seek Shore, he was a white Jewish man, okay, who you feel like he claimed more of an ownership of it than Gordon Parks Jr., the director, or Philip Fenty, who was the writer. So when it comes time to production, which occurs about 11 years later or so, we're doing it with Director X, Trevor Jackson. It's out the following year in 2018. What the critics at that time in the summer of 18, what they were saying was it was too much glitz and too much glam, very little substance. That's what they say. There may be something to that. And again, I think you hit it on the head. I think it was a case of we are in the 21st century now, and all of the nuances that helped make that story of its time a great success are no longer here now. There are so many changes. I really do believe that the filmmakers of the 2018 reboot were doing their best to adapt to its time by taking the locale of the story from New York to Atlanta, okay, making the characters younger, okay, replacing the Cadillac with the Lexus. I think they were trying to do the best that they can, but there are so many sociological and political nuances that also, and I think this is what taught me very much, it gives a story, all stories, foundation. Okay? Superfly 1972 was because of what it was, because it was a post-industrialization story in the time of post-industrialization. Okay? Now we are in the digital age.
Right.
I think that is, that's the collision. That is the mix-up right there.
And unfortunately, we are so out of time. Oh my gosh, this is an awesome
discussion,
as I knew it would be.
Well, thank you
so much for gracing us with your presence.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
You're welcome. Tell everybody how to get the book.
You can get the book from Amazon.com. All you have to do is type in the Superfly Trilogy and Boyd. B-O-Y-D. It takes you to the page instantly. The Superfly Trilogy, B-O-Y-D. And you can go to BarnesandNoble.com. I think it's B ampersand BNN.com, BarnesandNoble.com, BNN.com. Same thing, the Superfly Trilogy Boyd, and it'll be right there. Also, you can get it from direct from my publisher, Kiwi Publishing, KWEPUB.com. That's KWEPUB.com.
Awesome, awesome. Again, thank you. It is time for the Teens Talk Truth radio show, and you guys want to keep it locked right here because Professor Boyd's not done. He's got another lesson for us with the teens, and you do not want to miss it. So keep it locked while we get my sons, AJ and Alex Taylor, in here. They're going to discuss hot topics affecting teens in society today.
All right.
Especially during this Black History Month. So you don't want to miss it. Stay with us, folks. Oh, and don't forget, tune in tomorrow night at 5 o'clock p.m. Central Time for the Boomerang Radio Show hosted
Boomerang.
by me, William, Dr. Cecilia Sims, Reverend Dr. Rudolph Demery, and we're also going to have Mad Mike with us.
Oh, my God. No, let me tell you why I said that. Let me tell you why I said that. You guys are going, you have a heavy week to discuss talking about Atlanta. So I know everybody's gloves are going to be off, and I am very interested to hear what Mike has to say about that.
Oh boy.
I will tune in. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'd love to have you.
Yes. Now, if both of you noticed that I didn't even jump in, the conversation was so exciting. I said, well, let me just sit back and listen. There's no room for me here.
Well, you know, it was, as always, a riveting conversation. He is just such an awesome teacher. You can tell when you are in college and you've got a great professor versus somebody who's really good at understanding what they're doing, but they can't really teach it to somebody else. So you're one of those people that actually brings it alive, because I never thought about Superfly in the way that you made me think about it. Just like I never thought about Michael Jackson in the way that you made me think about it the last time you were.
I guess that's part or entirely my raison d'etre as an author, because what you said about Michael Jackson just now, that's what so many people told me during the campaign for Bless His Soul. I thought it was just good music to dance to. There's a lot more to it than that. And maybe that's my raison d'etre to take these elements of African American popular culture and to expose the profundity that's there.
Right.
Outstanding. And Professor, I'm still waiting for my autographed copy.
I know. Look, brother, I haven't forgotten about you.
Okay. All right. In a minute, while we are on this break, let me play this. Little Child Running Wild, Curtis Mayfield, from the original soundtrack, from a Superfly movie. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to The Buzz, Studio W, your global radio network.